You are listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast, focusing on the changing nature of retirement today and the non-financial aspects of a successful retirement transition. Join host Joe Casey and learn from leading experts in the field and the stories of people who created interesting second acts as they share practical ideas and tips to create your own. Check out our website at retirementwisdom.com, where you can download our newsletter and other resources to learn more about how coaching can help you. The best way to support this podcast is to head over to Apple Podcasts and post a rating and a comment. It's easy and it's free. Join our conversations and get wiser about your retirement.
Welcome to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. I think of retirement as multidimensional. Preparing for it isn't just about money, but it's also not just about some of the other things we often talk about. One of those areas is health and fitness. What about your mental fitness? What can you do to stay sharp and perhaps in some areas, become even sharper? Our guest today is Elizabeth Ricker. She's the author of the new book, Smarter Tomorrow, How 15 Minutes of Neurohacking a Day Can Help You Work Better, Think Faster, and Get More Done. Her work has been featured globally, including in the Wall Street Journal, Fast Company, on Sirius XM Radio, and on public broadcast TV in Europe. She has given talks on cognitive enhancement and neurohacking across the U.S. and overseas. She's a sought-after expert by Silicon Valley venture capital firms, tech startups, schools, and the Fortune 500. She runs a citizen neuroscience, do-it-yourself, and neurohacking organization, NeuroEducate, and her consulting and speaking work goes through Ricker Labs. She received her undergraduate degree in brain and cognitive sciences from MIT, and her graduate degree in mind, brain, and education from Harvard. In college, she worked in the neuroscience lab of Nobel Prize winner Dr. Susumu Tonegawa. Elizabeth was also a nationally ranked athlete and class president, the latter of which occasionally involved such serious duties as dressing up in a giant rodent costume to play Tim the Beaver, the MIT mascot. Elizabeth, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
So our listeners just heard your bio, but in reading your book, it's clear to me that there's much more to your story than just your impressive credentials. Can you share the story of your middle school math teacher?
Sure. Yeah. So throughout my early years in school, I had been struggling with kind of brain fog. And as a result, my performance in school tended to be a bit erratic. So one day I'd be absolutely focused, and then the next day I would be really struggling and not paying very close attention. And so there was one day during middle school that my math teacher called on me to answer a relatively simple multiplication problem. And it was one of my cotton ball head days. And my answer took an incredibly long time, and I don't even think it was correct. And he had this wonderful British accent, and he said, "Well, doesn't look like we've exactly got MIT material here now, do we?" And sort of chuckled and moved on. And at the time, I was hurt. I was a middle schooler. And he'd actually been a very supportive teacher before that. And so I remember leaving that classroom and having this sort of furious little middle school ire raging inside me and thinking, well, okay, what can I do to fix this? I never want to have this experience again. And that day kindled this desire to understand how my brain worked and also how I could start to treat it more like a tool that I would have control over as opposed to something that just sort of willed me in random directions and caused me to be humiliated at points. So then fast forward probably 10 plus years later, I was walking up to the podium to receive my MIT diploma. And I myself found myself kind of chuckling because I kind of wanted to take a photo and email it to my old math professor just to say, hey, you know, figured some things out.
I thought that spoke to your character because I would have found that hard to resist.
I didn't email it to him, it's true. Well, the thing is that he actually had been very challenging and supportive in many other ways. He just had a bit of a brutal sense of humor. So
how does your approach of neurohacking and scientific self-help work?
Yeah, so let me unpack those terms a little bit first. So neurohacking might be a bit of a scary word for some people. So let's take the two parts of it apart. So neuro, we're just referring to the brain. And hacking, I have a bit of a unconventional approach to what I mean by that word. So hacking is sort of curiosity-driven, playful approach to taking control, in this case, your mental performance. So the idea here is that oftentimes we relegate our health and our education to our teachers and our doctors to sort of be in control of our mental performance. But with neurohacking, the idea is that you take the driver's seat. So you take control over how you're going to be able to pay attention, remember, and focus day to day. So that's the sort of high level of neurohacking and a little bit of a backstory on the word hacking. At MIT, at least, we have this tradition of playing pranks that are called hacks. And that's sort of where the playfulness comes in. And then the other term that's relevant here is scientific self-help. So what I mean there is that we're all familiar with the term self-help and kind of as a broad category. And you have a lot of people who are kind of gurus in a particular area who are espousing an approach that worked really well for them or for their group of clients or the people that they work with most closely. And I think that's fantastic. You know, we all need ways to empower ourselves and to find methods that work well for whatever group we're dealing with. But where scientific self-help differs is it's a big focus on self-experimentation and self-tracking. So what this is there's measurement and personalization that is really, really key. And it's really embedded in this approach. So what I mean by that is that, let's say there's a self-help idea that says, you know, you should do these 10 things before you have breakfast in the morning, right? Like we get exposed to these sort of listicle articles that say, you know, Elon Musk does this 10 times a day, you should too. Well, scientific self-help takes a little bit of a different approach. It says, okay, well, that's an interesting idea. Let's test it. Let's see if this actually works for you. And at the heart of all of this is really the notion that what decades of neuroscience research are telling us is that each of our brains is actually quite unique. So when you look at the brain wiring of one person versus another, they can be, and actually are measurably, as unique as your fingerprints. So the notion that there's going to be a one-size-fits-all strategy that works perfectly for your brain and my brain and my mother's brain and my aunt's brain and my math teacher's brain is kind of impossible physically. So what you really need to do is you take these ideas and you test them on yourself. And what neurohacking teaches you how to do is actually how to run a very simple self-experiment, which is like a randomized control trial. This is the approach that scientists take in labs, but I've broken it down so that you can do this in 15 minutes a day. So it's actually very easy and doable, and you can actually get answers to questions of, does this work for me? Or is this just sort of an interesting story that people are talking about? I should kind of smile and nod.
It's a great collection of self-experiments, 15 minutes in the book. But I also really enjoyed reading about the many self-experiences that you've done and your stories about them. One that stood out to me was how you've been tracking your New Year's resolutions since 2011. And your life satisfaction score, something that people might think isn't quantifiable, life satisfaction. Can you tell us about that and what you learned from those experiments?
Yeah. So I think, first of all, when most of us think about New Year's resolution, we have mixed feelings. So there's this burst of excitement at the beginning of the year. There's all these things I want to do this year. It's going to be an amazing year. And then, you know, gyms tend to really benefit from this. They make lots of money in the first 2 months because everyone signs up for a new gym membership. And then oftentimes things don't look so good about 2 months later. So New Year's resolutions get kind of a bad rap because of this. So what I did is starting around 2011, I started to take more of a scientific approach. And I said, okay, I'm going to track my New Year's resolutions and I'm going to track my goals and I'm going to see how well this works out. And so I started doing that. I did that for a few years and I used a few different tools. I'd worked in tech and so I was familiar with software management and project management strategies. So I use some of the tools that get used in companies. I use them on myself. I had an accountability buddy. I had a lot of different approaches that come from sort of the habit change literature. And I tried to use these things on myself. And that was interesting. But what I found a few years later was that something seemed to be missing. And it felt like I was accomplishing things and I was getting my to-dos done, but something felt a little hollow. So I was like, what can I add to this? So I came across the positive psychology literature, and there is this wealth of studies, research, thinking about what is happiness and how do we actually quantify that in a person? And it sounds so philosophical, but how do we actually tackle it in a scientific way? And it's a very long literature, but it sort of, the most recent part starts in like the 70s. And so what I did is I adapted some tools that come from the literature, like Ed Diener is a very well-known legendary psychologist in this space. Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi is very, very well-known for flow. And there are a bunch of validated tools that are actually even available for free online that you can access yourself off of the UPenn Positive Psychology Center. So anyway, I took these tools and then I created a survey for myself that I called my life satisfaction scoring. So what I did going forward is I ran two tests in parallel. I tracked my say to do's, which was the things that I said I was going to do versus what I actually did, just sort of the standard productivity New Year's resolution type thing. But then I also tracked my life satisfaction scores. And the beauty of tracking both of these in parallel is that you start to see the weird disconnects. So oftentimes people say, oh, achievement or success can feel hollow. And that struck me as wrong because it seemed like, well, if that's really the case, then probably you're not aiming for the right things. So I actually found that in my own data that there were times when I was achieving quite a lot on my say-to-do scores, but my life satisfaction scores were lower. And then oddly enough, the opposite happens sometimes too. So what this taught me is that as you go through and you track yourself and you do these assessments, in the book I talk about exactly how to do this. You sit down with your accountability buddy, or you can do this on your own once a year, once a quarter, once a week, and even on a day-to-day basis, you can do these to-do list type approaches for say-to-do. And you do this tracking, but you also track your life satisfaction. And the point is to get better at creating goals that actually deliver satisfaction and happiness in your life. And I actually can testify that this does work because my first 2 years were very jagged and I had huge disconnects between my life satisfaction and my say-to-do scores. And they have over time begun to correlate a lot more strongly with one another, which I feel happy about, obviously, but it also sort of shows that this is possible.
And you include your scores in the graph in the book, so you can track every 2011, 2017. How about this year? Is your one goal that you set at the beginning of the year that's tracking and enhancing your life satisfaction?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there are two big things that have happened in my life over the last 12 to 15 months, I guess you could say. And that is that my husband and I welcomed a little boy into our lives.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. So our little guy is now over a year old. And so I have a whole new set of goals that I am tracking associated with his health and well-being and happiness. And some of the goals around basically taking on a new role, which is being a parent, have been some of the most high satisfaction and also high say-to-do scores that I've enjoyed doing over the last 12 months. And then the other one that's kind of obvious is that I just finished this book, Smarter Tomorrow, and the process of learning how to do a book launch and how to sort of introduce ideas to a broad range of people has been really exciting and has sort of taught me how do you break down a big dream and into, you know, turning it into small milestones and quantifiable steps. So those have really been the two big things that I've been focused on this year. And so far it's actually been going pretty well.
Congratulations on both. Those are two.
Thank you.
Two big ones.
Thanks a lot.
So what do middle-aged and older adults need to know about cognitive functioning that might be different than people expect?
Yeah, that's a great one. So this is not, I think, talked about as much as it should be, which is there are ways in which our brains actually get better as we get older. Our media and our society tends to be very youth obsessed. And there's a number of studies that have just been sitting around in the research literature that just don't get popularized very much. So one of them is in emotional self-regulation. So in my book, I talk about four mental targets that you can really hone in on and improve with neurohacking. And one of the really important ones is emotional self-regulation. So what I mean by that is kind of what it sounds like. So it's your ability to regulate your emotions, even if circumstances challenge you in various ways. So sometimes we think of this as resilience. But basically what's cool about this is that actually your emotional self-regulation on average in the population, obviously there's going to be individuals who are different from this, but on average, people's emotional self-regulation actually improves over time. So it tends to get better and better. So older adults, on average, are much stronger at emotional self-regulation than young people. So that's something to congratulate yourself on, right? Like hopefully over time, you're getting much, much better at this. Another area is crystallized knowledge. So areas like arithmetic and vocabulary, these two definitely seem to improve over time. And they don't really start to decline until you really hit older age. And it's actually thought that part of why that is happening is not because those abilities necessarily are declining, but really more that other issues like executive function, which I can talk about more, are causing your access to those abilities to get harder. So really, I think before you dive into all the things that, you know, the media is going to tell you that are falling apart as you get older, I think it's really important to just start with the things that you are probably stronger at than you realize. Because this is a really important thing with neurohacking, is to start with an understanding of where you're strong and then understand what your personal bottlenecks are so that you can personalize everything that you do and you don't just take one size fits all solutions, that you really are skeptical and curious and critical as you move through this process. So more specifically for middle age and older adults, the areas that do tend to cause more trouble for people and impair their ability to enjoy their lives and perform at the level that they wanted to, is you do start to see declines in what's called executive function. And what's executive function is really kind of colloquially what we would be thinking about is attention and working memory. And so that's things like being able to, if someone tells you their phone number, remember all of the digits and be able to write them down. And so in the period of time where you're hearing from it, you're hearing it said and then having to write it down, holding all of that in your mind and then being able to manipulate it. So that would be an example of working memory. And then being able to pay attention, switch your attention from one thing to another. This can come into play even in places like driving a car. So if you are having to deal with the fact that there's a lot of irrelevant information around you, as there is when you're driving, being able to pick out the most relevant piece of information, which is, say, the color of the street sign, so that you don't run a red light, right? That's something that can start to get harder as you're getting older. But the good news with all of these things is that we have a wealth of data that is growing that shows that with training, these abilities absolutely can be improved. So there's a great example by an incredibly esteemed neuroscientist here, who's an emeritus from UCSF. So Michael Merzenich is a neuroplasticity pioneer, and he helps develop actually commercially available brain game called Brain HQ. But from the research side, this was built on a series of studies, including one that was NIH funded on 3,000 people, randomized controlled trial that was called the ACTIVE study. And they found that even on measures of what I mentioned before with driving, older adults were playing these video games that were very carefully designed. And they actually improved not just while they were playing the games and not just on the abilities that the game very narrowly focused on, but they also improved on other areas. For instance, they had better driving records than people who did not play those games. And these gains actually seem to persist even many years later. So that's actually very, very exciting and encouraging. So again, I think this is a very long answer to your question, but basically I think, you know, start with the things that you should feel confident about and, you know, proud of yourself for that actually improve with age, and then take a close look at, okay, well, what are the things that are bothering me and how can I specifically take action? And certainly perhaps joining your grandkids or your children, or if you're already a video gamer, great, do it. Try it out. It can be a wonderful experience for everyone to get involved. And one last thing on that score, there was a UCSF study that actually made the cover of Nature magazine, which is a very important science journal. And that was for NeuroRacer, which was some people may have heard about. And it was one where there was a video game that was played by older adults. And then they compared the performance of those older adults to untrained 20-year-olds. And the older adults who had played the game actually had higher executive function scores on these types of abilities after having played the games than the 20-year-olds did, which is very unexpected and pretty impressive.
Absolutely. So we know about IQ and EQ, but what's the new IQ and the new EQ?
Yeah. So these are just sort of fun phrases that I came up with that I thought would be more memorable than executive function and emotional self-regulation, which are sort of researcher speak. So new IQ is what we would think of as executive function. The reason I chose that term is because our culture has been, not currently, but previously was a bit obsessed with this notion of IQ. And in recent years, it's become more controversial, and I think rightly so. But there is still this notion of, okay, well, there must be just one intelligence. There's smart people and there's dumb people, and I kind of want to know which group I'm in, right? And what we learn from the research literature is that executive function is an ability that everyone has. And depending on what's going on in your life, this, what I'm calling new IQ, which is really executive function, is your ability to, you know, pay attention, have mental flexibility. So that means being able to shift conceptually from one idea to another, also solving problems on the fly. So say doing mental arithmetic, that would certainly work your working memory. So these kinds of things, they actually go up and down throughout your life and even throughout a day. So as your attention changes and your arousal and your alertness levels, that's also going to affect your executive function. So new IQ is a very, very important measure, because when you look at very long-range studies of long-term outcomes, you find that this correlates quite well with professional success, academic success, and oddly enough, there's a component of it which is sort of related to self-regulation and impulse control. It even can relate very strongly with marital and long-term relationships. So it's a very important one. And then new EQ is, again, what we talked about before with emotional self-regulation. So it's this notion that you can kind of understand what you're currently feeling, and then sort of that's the monitoring stage, and then come up with ideas to potentially modify it. So if you're experiencing an uncomfortable feeling, like let's say you're about to go into a big presentation, you're feeling very, very nervous, it might be natural to go deep into that feeling and then just become panicked. And that would be natural, but not advantageous. So what emotional self-regulation would allow you to do is say, okay, I'm feeling this nervousness. How can I reframe this and turn it into excitement, which is a usable feeling? And so that's, there are different strategies that you can use to do that. So again, both of these things are very modifiable. They're also very important. And we have long-term studies, you know, decades on thousands of participants that have indicated that these things correlate very strongly with long-term life success. But that would not be particularly interesting if it was not changeable. But both of these things are actually changeable. And that's what I focus on in the book, is how do you actually improve these? What are the interventions that you can use to improve them?
So you mentioned bottlenecks before, because you were talking about driving, I thought of traffic patterns, but that's not what you mean. So what are some of the common lifestyle bottlenecks, and how can they be addressed?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when you start your neurohacking, I kind of think of there being a pyramid. So before you get into the really fancy neurohacks, like later on in the book, I talk about neurostimulation, neurofeedback, these sort of lab grade technologies that are now, due to the decrease in consumer technology pricing, available actually at home, which is also very exciting. But you should really start with these lifestyle interventions. So things like your sleep, things like your exercise, nutrition, even things that you might not think of as being directly related to brain health, but we have increasing amounts of data that show that they really, really are, which is things like social connectedness, because loneliness is absolutely correlated with a lot of health disorders that affect the brain very strongly. And then, you know, there's a number of things. I have a whole health and lifestyle survey that I introduce at the end of chapter 6 called Debugging Yourself, that allows you to go through and see where you're at. But in terms of what do I mean by a bottleneck, there are general standards that you want to check to see whether you're sort of falling above or below. So we're all probably familiar with this idea that, you know, about 30 minutes of moderate exercise a day is a great way to stay healthy and stave off a lot of even age-related declines, but you know, just generally a very useful thing to do. But for each of these things, for any given person, let's say you're a marathon runner, maybe exercise is not your bottleneck, but maybe sleep is. So I have some unusual hacks that you might want to consider for each of these areas. So for instance, with sleep, sleep apnea is sometimes an issue for people. And there was a rather unconventional study that I saw in the British Medical Journal that showed that using the didgeridoo, which is an Australian wind instrument, actually learning how to play this can, or at least in this randomized controlled trial, showed that participants had a significant reduction in their symptoms associated with sleep apnea. And this is bizarre, right? Why would that help? The notion is that you are strengthening the underlying core cause, or one of the underlying core causes of sleep apnea, which is having the muscles in your throat be a bit too loose. And so it tones those muscles to play the didgeridoo. So this is not recommended for extremely severe sleep apnea. This was more for kind of minor or moderate, sort of lower levels of sleep apnea, but it's something to try if, you know, you're not interested in trying to do a CPAP, for instance. So anyway, I go through a bunch of different lifestyle and health-related areas that can be bottlenecks tied directly to cognitive performance. And if you find that you are relative to the other areas, that you're low in that one, that's a bottleneck for you. I have very specific and possibly counterintuitive suggestions for each one. I'll add one last one that might be unexpected, which is for exercise. There are some really kind of, to me, they seemed funny, but I think they're actually quite popular apps. Like for instance, there's one called Sweat Coin, and that one is actually paying you to work out. So you are really going to be motivated to work out because you actually earn money as you use the app and as it records the exercise having been accomplished in either your wearable device or in your app. So it's a very fun time to be alive as a neurohacker because we just have a lot of cool apps and wearables and devices available now that I used to have to literally build in the lab.
What's the coolest one you're currently using?
Well, I'm actually about to start a new experiment. And this is actually one of my favorite technologies from the last few years. So this is neurofeedback. So some people may be familiar with the idea of biofeedback. So this is, you know, you're using a particular sensor to access the body's internal state. So in this case, you have electrodes that are reading brain waves from your head. Typically, there's a headset that you can buy. The consumer devices that I've tended to use are under $250 to buy. And what it is, it just looks like a funny headband. And then you have electrical activity coming through the headband that is then transmitted to your phone. And then you put in headphones and then you listen. Typically, you close your eyes and then you can listen to music that is changing in response to your brainwaves. And so what you do is you actually learn to modify your brainwaves over time. This sounds kind of silly or sci-fi or improbable, but I was very skeptical when I first started looking into this. But it actually turns out that the science is quite solid and there are decades of research on its use in clinical disorders ranging from ADHD to originally it was tried for epilepsy and it's been in a bunch of different areas. But the one that it's most interesting for, at least from a commercial setting, is really meditation. So essentially teaching you how to meditate a lot faster than you might otherwise if you're just attempting to sit on a pillow, stare at the wall and wonder whether you're quote unquote doing it right. This is one of the ones I'm excited about because I would say recently I've been having a little more trouble with some of the areas of attention that I monitor. And so I wanted to work on that. So that's my current relative bottleneck. And so I'm going to be I also do neurohacking. So my upcoming intervention is going to be 10 minutes of neurofeedback a day. And I test myself before I start and then I do the intervention and then I test myself right after. And then I track this over a 12-week period. And I talk about exactly how to do that in the book.
And I'm imagining there's a pre-parent version of what you were doing and post-parent. There's a life tends to change.
You got it, Joe. Yep. You have 100% nailed it. Yeah. The funny thing is that when you look at my personal data before my son was born versus after, there is a gap. And that is a gap from just attempting to survive. Anyone who's had a kid, I think, will understand, appreciate that when you're running on 3 hours of sleep, it's pretty hard to do almost anything.
Absolutely. Heroic efforts it requires. We have four. They're all grown. Our youngest is 20, but
It
comes with its own challenges as well. But nothing better, as you know.
It is amazing. But yeah, one of the hardest things I've ever done.
No question. So you mentioned video games before, and you mentioned Brain HQ. How can serious brain games improve executive function?
Yeah. So is the question sort of how or which ones, you know, work best? Or let me unpack that a little bit more.
Sure. So I was thinking about how it works, but I think that's a bit better correction in terms of what works best. So if someone wanted to improve executive function and they were attracted to the games as a solution, what would you recommend?
Yeah, that's great. So it really depends on what you're aiming for. I mean, you mentioned executive function, which is a great mental target. There are sort of different categories of video games that you could potentially try. So there are things that I would say are considered entertainment first. So they weren't really designed to improve brains, but the research actually does indicate that they can be relatively promising. So that's things like action video games. And so in a head-to-head study between Lumosity, which is sort of one of the best known brain game makers, versus one of the action video game offerings, the latter actually did do better, at least in the short run. So it was a very, very short study. And in that one, there were some improvements. But I think the larger question is sort of what is your risk tolerance? What is your desire with respect to the scientific literature? So for me, what I tend to do is I start all of my interventions and my self-experiments with tools that are really, really well vetted. And so I try to start with things that have thousands of people on them, that are randomized controlled trials, it's very deep research. Because it just seems like if you only have 15 minutes a day to do this thing, you want to get a lot of bang for your buck. And so I would say that probably starting with something like the Brain HQ or comparing it with, say, maybe even the dual NBAC. That's another interesting research fact. It's a lot more controversial, but it might be an interesting comparison for people to see. That might be another option for looking into improving executive function. And I talk more in the book about what exactly dual NBAC is and all the different types of video games. There's a whole chapter on what are called serious games, and that's chapter 17.
So one thing that got my attention in the book, among many, some of your commentary about diets and the various deficiencies. Our youngest daughter is 23, and she became a vegan in high school, so we've adopted that. I was partially vegan.
Yeah.
Then I went completely vegan. I have to learn more about it. So,
oh, wow, yeah.
Very useful chart in the book about deficiencies and things to pay attention to. What are some of the things people should watch out for with different diets, and what's the MIND diet?
Yeah, so many great questions all packed up into that one. So in terms of deficiency, so let's just start there. This graphic that I included was not one that I made. It was actually from a wonderful website called examine.com, which is, I think, a great resource that people should know about who are interested in nutrition. It's very science-based. They have links to the scientific research papers that they're basing their commentary on. So it's wonderful. So what that infographic is actually showing is it's taking a number of very popular diets and it's saying, okay, well, you know, you can go ahead and do these diets, but you should be aware that they do tend to come along with some specific deficiencies. So, you know, paleo, vegan, vegetarian, there's just a whole bunch, South Beach diet. For each of these, there do tend to be issues. And it's not that you can't do that diet without becoming sick or running into problems, but it's just that you should realize that you're going to have to probably supplement yourself if you try those approaches. So that's a very useful resource, and I would recommend that people check it out either on Examine or in my book. And an interesting offshoot from that is that there was a study that showed that supplementing with creatine was actually tied to fluid intelligence gains. So a measure of, it's sort of related to executive function, but basically there was a measured study that looked at people who had been supplementing with creatine, and they had surprisingly large gains in this aspect of their mental ability. Now, the question is, the people in that study were vegetarians. And so there's a thought that they actually were improved more by taking creatine because they actually were deficient in something related to creatine due to the vegetarian diet. So that's, again, look at things like B12, look at things like creatine. I don't want to go through the whole infographic because it's pretty intense, but that's just sort of a heads up that whatever you choose, you should really pay attention to that. I actually tried being a vegetarian for a year, which my family laughed when they heard this because I had been such a rabid steak eater as a child that you basically, if you wanted to have me be a happy camper, just sit me down in front of a steak and a watermelon and I'd just go to town for a few hours. Just a skinny kid that ate like enormous amounts of food that just boggled the mind. So I told them I was going to be a vegetarian and their response was laughter. I did do it for a year, but then I went in for my, you know, yearly physical and my doctor said, well, you are deficient in iron. You were deficient in all these various things because I hadn't also actually become a good cook at the same time. So that's one of the things when you have an experiment, you should also make sure you're modifying other aspects of your life. So again, it's not to say that you can't be an incredibly healthy vegetarian. It's a fantastic lifestyle, but you do need to modify some things if you want to do it correctly and well. So to your second question, what is the MIND diet? So that's it's an interesting one where I think we have more empirical research than we do sort of conceptual or method, sort of underlying mechanism type research. So what I mean by that is that we have correlations of saying, hey, when people follow this diet, they tend to have lower levels of neurodegenerative diseases, even things like Alzheimer's, which is kind of amazing because that's not something that we have to date had a lot of control over. So what the MIND diet is it's sort of a combination of the Mediterranean diet and something called DASH, which DASH is short for dietary approach to stop hypertension. And what the MIND diet actually ends up being is essentially eating a lot of veggies, nuts, beans, berries, olive oil, poultry, and fish. And then it's limiting specific fats. So things like butter, margarine, fried foods, and then also cheese, red meat, and sweets and pastries. So if you want the specifics of exactly how many of each of those items you're supposed to have per week, which is the details of the MIND diet. There's actually a free article that I recommend that you could check out on healthline.com. And they have a full article on the MIND diet. And then again, I don't think at this point we really understand extremely well why this works, but there is some preliminary research that's showing that it may be due to decreases in inflammation and oxidative stress that eating these foods can help with, and also avoiding those foods that I mentioned before can help with. So that's sort of a start on the nutrition side. But again, I'm by no means a nutrition expert. I just sort of, my job in this book is to just present the best of what I've found from a lot of other people's research that is kind of gets to a certain level of randomized control trial data and so forth.
Appreciate that. And thanks for your patience with my double and triple barrel questions.
No, it's great. Those are wonderful, wonderful questions.
So you mentioned before accountability buddy. How can having an accountability partner help?
Yeah, I would say that having an accountability buddy or partner, even an accountability chain, which is where you, instead of just account, you know, you have a buddy and you report on what you've done to them and they report on what they've done to you. A chain would be, let's say I say, hey, Joe, I did this week. And then you say, that's nice, Elizabeth. And then you go and report to someone else about what you did that week. And then that person reports to someone else what they did that week. So that's a chain as opposed to a buddy. So all of these can work. And I would say that they have some of the same benefits. So there's accountability, there's fun, there's motivation, and then there's also the insights. And so what I mean by that is you can get into a little bit of an echo chamber with yourself if you are the same person who is recording data day in, day out, and trying things out and saying, you know, I'm trying this new nutrition diet, I'm trying this new neurofeedback thing. And it's exciting for a little while to do this thing by yourself, but oftentimes we need that social sort of motivation, that energy to keep a new habit going. And there's a lot of research on this. Like, for instance, there was a study that combined writing down goals with having an accountability partner and sending in weekly progress reports. And they found that people who did that, as opposed to people who just wrote down goals or just said the goal out loud, or there are various versions of this, the people who both had the accountability buddy and wrote down their goals, they far outperformed. I mean, it was like over a 2x multiplier. This was a study that was done at a school just outside of San Francisco a few years ago. I believe it was University of San Domingo, but I have to go back and check on that. So anyway, writing things down and also having an accountability partner is a fantastic combination to make sure you actually stick with this new life-improving approach. And then in terms of insights, I've often heard things from my accountability buddy that I just didn't see myself. I mean, she'll look at my data, she'll look at my charts, and then she'll be like, hey, this looks a lot like a problem that you were struggling with last quarter. Have you thought of that? I was like, no, I did not think of that. Thank you for bringing that up. So it's just the beauty of having someone else look at you actually in a sort of a deep and intimate way that can be very helpful. I will say one thing though, it's important when you're dealing with something that's as personal as mental performance data to share only as much as you feel comfortable with. And one way that I recommend doing this is that you just share percent change. And so what I mean by that is, let's say you take a self-assessment that indicates that your executive function is like a 7 out of 10 on some measure, right? And you do that at the very beginning of your self-experiment, and then you begin your self-experiment. It's possible that the intervention you've chosen doesn't help, and maybe it goes down. Maybe your intervention, or maybe something else is going on in your life, and that causes it to go down. So you might feel uncomfortable about the fact that that's happening, and maybe you don't want to share that with someone else. And so what you can do is you can just say, my percent has decreased from my baseline by whatever percentage at this point. And then that is still useful information that your buddy can comment on, but they don't have to know your precise numbers, because maybe your buddy was starting at 9 out of 10, or maybe your buddy was starting at 3 out of 10. And you don't want to have those types of awkwardness ruin your relationship with your buddy. So those percent changes can actually be a great way to solve that problem.
That's a great tip. One last question, if I could. So what are the key messages that you'd like people to take away when they read your book, Smarter Tomorrow?
Yeah, well, I mean, my hope is that everyone becomes a neurohacker. So I'm just hoping that, you know, you read the book and then you just feel fired up and you go to the last section of the book where there's 20 self-experiments, and then you just pick one and then you just dive in. So that ends up being, you know, 15 minutes of your day for maybe the rest of your life. I mean, that would be fantastic. But I think even if you're not ready to make that jump, my sort of high level goal is really to leave readers with two things. One is that you can take a very scientific approach to your life, and that things that seem kind of abstract and maybe not under your control, like life satisfaction or your mental performance, Some of us think of it as intelligence. These things seem uncontrollable. They seem like you're either born with them or fate seems to play a role and you just don't have control over them. And what I want to really introduce to people is that we actually have a lot of data and we have this tool, which is self-experimentation, that can allow you to actually take control over it. And if it helps at all, when you look back at the number of Nobel Prize winners who have won awards in medicine or physiology, a surprising percentage of them actually ran self-experiments in the exact area that they won their Nobel Prize in. So you'll be in pretty good company. This is not some unscientific stuff. This is something that even very, very esteemed scientists have done themselves. So no reason why you can't ask and approach things just like a Nobel Prize winner.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for taking the time to share all this with us. Very, very helpful and very inspiring work.
I'm so glad. It was fun. Wonderful. Thank you so much. It's great fun.
Thanks again. Wow, what a great conversation with Elizabeth Ricker. Appreciate her making the time to share really a wealth of information on her research, tools, and her knowledge about how we can all maintain our mental fitness. And the first takeaway for me is the 15 minutes a day. Raise the question, is it worth it? I think undoubtedly, yes. And where can you get 15 minutes a day? Look at the usual suspects, social media, TV, other types of things you do that you can put that time to better use, like this. And I think it's certainly worth the investment. She has 20, as she mentioned, self-experiments detailed in the book. I'm starting one. I can tell you they look fun and they look very interesting. And the drama about which one's going to work for you is really intriguing. And that leads me to my second takeaway. Every brain is different. Her description of neurodiversity. So what are the right things for you? What's the right combination to unlock your potential? Third, there's this fundamental aspect of things we know. Diet, eating right, getting enough rest, getting the right amount of sleep, and getting the right amount of exercise. But this gives you some additional tools to measure it and take those things up to perhaps the next level. Up a notch or two. And don't forget also, she talked about, in addition to cognitive functioning, emotional regulation, the new EQ. And while the good news, as she mentioned, research shows that we get better at that with age as we get older, there's still a lot of uncertainty and changes that come with this part of life. And it's good to have that in the mix as well. And then my final point, she mentioned the value of an accountability partner. My work as a coach, I can tell you that people value that quite a bit, and it really helps people stay on track and keep things moving forward. So give that some thought. How can you be part of a group or part of a team with someone else who may want to take on these challenges as well? It can really help you stay on track and go further. Thank you for listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. You can find all of our episodes, all four seasons, at our website, retirementwisdom.com. You'll also find the link where you can schedule a call to talk about how we might be able to help you. If you're listening to this podcast, you've worked hard to be able to plan for retirement, and you're probably still in the throes of that. But think about it. You probably aren't working this hard to have a so-so retirement. And you can really sidestep the pitfalls that I see derail too many retirements. And these pitfalls could waste your most valuable asset of all, your time. Instead, you can take time to design your new life using the same principles of design thinking that companies like Apple, Nike, and other companies use. But now you can apply it to your future. Get ahead of the game. Start here with Retirement Wisdom. We have the tools to help you design your new life.
Thank you for joining us today on the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. You can listen to all episodes of our podcast by subscribing to them on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher, or on our website at retirementwisdom.com.